Now we learn that at least significant portions of what Lochte said was true.
Even the Brazilian police agree it's unlikely that Lochte or any of the other swimmers will face jail time.
Bill and Hillary's Clinton Foundation is beefing up cybersecurity over growing concerns that its data systems have also been hacked.
More communities are bracing for historic water levels as Louisiana's record rainfall moves downstream.
Uber China, which has been struggling, is now going to merge with a company called Didi. Also, what's interesting is that Didi is going to put $1 billion back into Uber Global. They've done okay in this deal this morning.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is Friday. It's August 19th, 2016, 5:10 a.m. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Welcome to another business day, the last of the business week here on 720 WGN. Glad to have you along with us. Lots of questions this morning. Will it be Uber, Didi, China, or Uber, China, Didi, or Uber, or Didi, China, Uber, or I don't know. We'll be scratching our heads on that one throughout the morning. Maybe Paul Nolte will have the answer when we check in with him, but lots of questions. There's lots of questions, too, moving forward about whether or not we're going to see an interest rate hike this year, and it could really be driving a driver of the markets today. We're already seeing Dow futures off about 45. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. Around the world this morning from the WGN market desk in Asia and in Europe, the markets generally mixed. In Asia, the Nikkei was up almost 0.5%. The Hang Seng down. The Shanghai was up. Also, the Asian Dow was down. In Europe, all of the arrows pointing down. In London, the FTSE 100 off about almost 0.5%, 16 points. The DAX in Germany lower as well, almost 0.5% there. The CAC lower as well in France, almost 0.5%. And all of the other indices, too, lower. Again, Dow futures pointing toward a lower open on Wall Street. Here's some of what you need to know moving forward. As we mentioned, those Asian benchmarks drifted lower today. Investors appear to be hunkering down to mull over resurgent oil prices and corporate earnings while they wait a key speech by the Federal Reserve chief next week. The next big chance to glean insight from the U.S. Central Bank official comes in a week's time with Janet Yellen due to speak at an annual gathering of central bankers at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. That'll be on August 26. On Wall Street, major U.S. benchmarks edged up slightly yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrials picked up about 23 points. The Standard & Poor's added about 5 points. The Nasdaq rose about 12 points. Benchmark U.S. crude oil stands at about $48.50 a barrel today. The dollar strengthened against the yen and the euro. Let's bring in Paul Nolte from Kingsview Asset Management for our regular Friday conversation. Paul, what do you think? Is it going to be Didi China Uber or Uber Didi China or just Uber Uber Didi?
I think we already have a P. Diddy, so I'm not quite sure how we're going to reconcile this one. This one will be a tough one.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. Well, it's good to have you with us on this Friday morning. There is a little bit of a consternation about the interest rate hikes. It doesn't seem the minutes provided any clear data about where the Federal Reserve is going.
Well, I think actually it provides a little bit of movement in the fact that we're starting to see some of the Fed governors talk a little bit more seriously about hiking rates. Up to this point, it's been pretty well unanimous. We're going to stay on the sidelines and allow things to go as they are. We've talked about it the last couple of weeks and the fact that the Fed, I think, is not necessarily watching the economic data, but looking at the financial markets. And the financial markets have quieted down. It's been, you know, it's been a boring August. Everybody is away on vacation. Volumes are way down. And the markets are pretty well behaved, very close to all-time highs. And I think the Fed feels comfortable that if they raise rates and the markets have a little bit of a get into a little bit of a funk and sell off 2, 3, 5% even, that the markets still are in good shape and can handle a quarter point hike. And so they're still talking maybe September, but certainly by the end of the year, and the betting on Wall Street is starting to reflect that.
Is that loss in capital today, the 5 to 10% you mentioned there, is that something that we might expect to come out of the market today? Everyone is expecting a rough day on Wall Street.
Well, I mean, you know, rough date is a quarter of a percent, a third of a percent. And that's in light of, again, a very flat August. Really, when you look at a market that goes down 3 to 5%, that's more what I would consider the market breathing. It happens very often. It's not anything that you really want to try to set portfolios for. Just understand that the markets do go down just as much as they go up, but they do go up over time. What I'm more concerned about is the possibility of a recession, and that can take 10%, 20%, or 30% out of the market. We really don't see that at this point, so we think at least the Fed has some reasonable standing to say we can increase rates here.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Overseas stocks are mixed as the world's economy continues its waiting game to see if the Fed plans to raise interest rates. Oil prices have gone up 23% in the last 15 days. Today, we'll learn how many rigs are operating in the U.S., which could indicate if American producers are reacting to the global hike. Viacom and its controlling shareholders, Sumner Redstone, have agreed to a settlement. It would see Chief Executive Philippe Dowman leave the company. It's the latest chapter in the ongoing power struggle over the 93-year-old Redstone's empire, valued at $40 billion. Viacom stock has slumped in recent months, but shares have been on the rise since Redstone acted to remove Dowman from the board in May. A federal judge said Uber's proposed $100 million payment to about 380,000 drivers is unfair. Uber had earmarked the payment in response to claims they were exploiting drivers by classifying them as independent contractors rather than employees. Brian Clark, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 519. Welcome back to the program as we continue our conversation this morning with Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management. Paul, one of our listeners just sent me a link to a story that is dated from 2010, and you can almost replace the dates and people with the times of now. It seems like this Federal Reserve debate after minutes are released seems to be one that happens, annually. And the question is it something that actually hurts or helps the markets?
You know, that's been the debate now for a while as the Fed has become more transparent or attempting to be more transparent and allowing the markets to understand what they're thinking. If you go back 20, 30 years, or certainly even to the Volcker Fed, minutes weren't released. And you had to kind of guess what the Fed was actually doing via their open market committee or their transactions in the open market. And it usually was a couple months before you actually kind of figured out what they were doing. I don't know if it's necessarily better, but it creates a much shorter term window. I mean, we're already talking about Yellen's discussion at Jackson Hole next Friday as giving us a little bit more guidance. So we're going from milepost to milepost as opposed to actually looking forward and looking down the road at economic data or at earnings for companies to kind of determine where we should be in the marketplace.
And some of the FOMC members as well have been out speaking. Yesterday, I believe the Federal Reserve president from San Francisco was out, and he said, you know, the time I think has come for this decision to be made for interest rates to go up, but not showing his hand about whether or not he favored September or December. And then another Federal Reserve president was out saying he favored December. So here we go with this, you know, this these trial balloons that are floated out and about, and that's really what they are, aren't they?
They are, and you know, and I think part of what they're trying to do is get the markets prepared for it. So, you know, we're seeing a market that has kind of gone sideways, down a little bit here today in expectation that, well, maybe the Fed is a little serious about this. And so if the market's reaction is fairly muted, I think that emboldens the Fed to say, yeah, okay, we can go ahead and raise rates and not upset the apple cart too much. And again, that's why I said I think the Fed is really more focused on the economic data, or I'm sorry, on the market data than the economic data. That's just a huge shift over the last 10, 15 years in how the Fed operates.
And so as we head into this Friday, it's one of those situations where we shouldn't be nervous about our portfolios. We have you to be nervous for us. What do you foresee as the correction that we might see? I mean, what if the markets are going to react today in a muted way, what would that be?
You know, it's going to be maybe a quarter point loss. It takes away some of the gain that we saw yesterday. The markets are essentially flat for the month of August. And again, I think portfolios were shifting away from some of the higher dividend yielding parts of the market, so the utilities, the consumer staples, and we're going a little bit more toward the growth side as the economy maybe tries to pick up a little bit of steam here. We look more to some of the more cyclical names in the market, the materials, industrials, and certainly technology. We still like bonds here. We don't think bonds are going to get hurt too terribly bad because a quarter point's not meaningful. But I think we want to move away from some of the higher dividend yielding parts of the equity market.
Were there anything? Was there anything from the week that that you liked in terms of what we saw? I mean, we saw a few of the big retailers come in with pretty decent earnings. The Home Depot, the Lowe's, Target. Also, we saw retailers like Walmart come in ahead of expectations. We also see that unemployment requests for first-time jobless benefits are pretty flat. All of these things look good for the economy.
You know, it looks okay. We're certainly, you know, if you take a look at how this recovery has occurred from 2008, 2009 to today, the trajectory for that recovery is very, very flat relative to other recoveries. So we haven't got the big boost that we would normally expect, but this is now one of the longest on record, rivaling the one in the 90s for length. But as far as the robustness of the growth, it's one of the worst on record. So, again, we're kind of muddling through with the 1.5% economic growth, which is not terrible, but certainly not recessionary. And that's why the Fed's wringing their hands about raising rates, because they feel that the economy is kind of on the edge and may get pushed into a recession if they're too aggressive on monetary policy.
I got an email yesterday from one of our listeners with a question for you about, I know we talk about a lot of about treading water these days with the markets and sort of just keeping our own with, you know, what direction are things going. But he asked if you have extra money in the market, where would you put it if there were no rules in terms of, you know, if your main portfolio was okay and you had a little extra cash to throw at the market, where would you put it?
Well, right now, for us, the cheapest part of the market we're starting to see some decent strength from is emerging markets. It's going to be a little bit more volatile, so it's going to move more than the U.S. markets will, both on the upside and the downside. But from a valuation perspective, it's probably one of the cheapest parts of the market. So for equity investors, we're putting money in emerging markets. We're sending money overseas. We feel it's going to get treated better there than in the U.S. over the next 3 to 5 years. So for us, that's a good place to go.
I also saw a commercial this past week on television about municipal bonds, and the elderly couple that was doing the commercial, they were talking about how they put their money, always make money in municipal bonds. I know you and I talk a lot about bonds, but are municipal bonds different from the bonds you and I talk about?
They're in the same spectrum. The benefit of municipal bonds is they're not taxable. So it doesn't make sense to put them in an IRA account because the IRA account's already non-taxable. So if for your taxable money or for the money that you have that you're going to pay taxes on, municipal bonds make sense. The income that you receive is tax exempt. They generally will move with interest rates. So as interest rates go down, the value of those bonds will rise just like any other bonds. The attraction for a lot of people is the fact that, again, they trade fairly close in yield to corporate bonds and government bonds. So for somebody that's in, say, the 20-25% tax bracket, instead of buying a treasury bond or a corporate bond, it probably makes sense for them to buy a municipal bond. The income is a little bit less, but since I don't have to pay taxes on it, when all is said and done on April 15th, I have more money with municipals. So for a lot of those taxable accounts, municipals do make sense for the fixed income side.
Paul Nolte of Kingsview Asset Management in Chicago, portfolio manager and our go-to guy on Fridays for a conversation about the economy and business. It's good to chat with you as always, Paul.
Absolutely.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:38 on this Friday edition of The Opening Bell. Glad to have you with us as we head into the weekend. Our conversation switches now to millennials and their growing influence over business-to-business research and purchasing decisions. We thought we would bring in the editor of Fierce CMO to the conversation this morning, Patrick Gorman, who's with us on the line this morning. Patrick, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. We talk a lot about the millennial group in a lot of different areas, how they're influencing a lot of different decisions. But this is something unique. If, in fact, they're growing in their impact on the actual business-to-business decisions companies are making in both research and purchasing.
It's true. And, you know, recent data from a variety of sources shows that, you know, up to 60 to 70% of millennials within B2B organizations are part of the purchasing decision, whether that's part of the buying committee or the committees that are making decisions on buying these purchases, while one-third, up to 33%, report being the final decision maker for these kind of purchases. So their role within these organizations is growing, and it's probably only going to be rising moving forward.
Well, give us a sense of what the decisions would be like that they would be making that we're talking about here, because I know a lot of people don't necessarily understand or are familiar with the language that we're using, the B2B purchasing, this kind of thing. Give us a sense of what we're talking about.
Certainly. So these are folks who are making purchases for their businesses from other businesses. So these, as opposed to consumer-facing brands where, you know, and regular products that normal folks would make, these folks are making decisions, purchases for their companies. So this this can branch from large technology purchases to manufacturing types of purchases. But you know, and for example, something such as a major technology purchase, these can be very big ticket items. So they require a lot of research, a lot of thought, and they impact a lot of people who are going to be using them. So marketers who are going to be kind of communicating to this audience really need to take into consideration some of the things that when they're going to be selling to millennials, they need to keep that in mind because it's a very different audience than past generations.
So there are a couple of things I want to tear apart here. First is this notion that they're making buying decisions for companies. What is it that other marketing firms need to know about this going into these discussions? It's clearly the millennials, it's a different the brand altogether, if you think about it as a brand. What is it? How big could this be for them?
It's certainly, when you're selling directly to an audience like millennials, you really have to keep a few things in mind. You want to keep channels in mind, things where folks are doing their research and how they are consuming content. So, in a lot of cases, millennials are turning to online sources, digital sources, face-to-face meetings with salespeople to kind of walk them through and explain different products and technologies that are out there. Obviously, online channels like websites are extremely important. You know, there's a lot of different places where millennials are digging for information. Especially in terms of search engine optimizations, websites, social media presence, these are things you really want to keep in mind on both on mobile and on regular devices when you're going to be selling to B2B millennials.
And then the other part of this is there are still a lot of non-millennials in these companies that will have to live with the decisions that these millennials are making. Talk to me a little bit about that, because that could be a little tricky area too, right?
Oh, certainly. You know, and obviously, as millennials are rising in the workforce and, you know, gaining experience and getting a little bit more influence within these organizations, there's still plenty of other folks out there who are part of these buying committees. So it's important to kind of keep your doors open and make sure that you're communicating to a larger audience as well. Insofar as targeting your content, targeting your message to millennials, that is an important thing moving forward. But you really can't lose sight of the fact that the organizations include all sorts of people. While communicating your message and making sure that you're engaging audiences kind of across the board, it's important to kind of keep your doors open on all fronts to make sure that you're not leaving anyone feeling alienated.
Give us a sense of what the numbers are here, Patrick. I know that for technology purchases, it was 61% of responding millennials said that they had described their role as the decision maker with purchases. Is it that high with other things as well in the B2B world?
It is. You know, recently the data from across the board kind of shows between 60% to 70% of millennials who have responded to these kind of reports describe their role on purchases within their organization as decision maker. You know, whether that means they're part of a larger buying committee, as often within B2B organizations, there's a larger committee of people who kind of have a little bit of input into large purchases, because these kind of decisions, especially when it comes to technology or things that are impacting a large amount of people, have a lot of input. But, you know, as those committees kind of expand, they're going to include a lot of different folks, and millennials are right in there. But as I said, about one-third are reporting being the final decision-maker, the people who are actually cutting the checks on these kind of purchases. So that's something to definitely keep in mind moving forward as marketers are trying to reach these audiences.
As somebody with a lot of experience in this area, maybe you could describe for us the level of trust that has been placed with millennials so quickly in their rise up through the ranks here. I mean, to make these kinds of decisions, that's a big responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. But, you know, especially in areas such as technology, I mean, this is a language that millennials speak quite a bit better than some of the other folks in organizations. You know, even folks in Generation X who might be a little bit more tech savvy. Some organizations that maybe newer startups or that have a lot of younger hires coming in on the tech side. There's a lot of folks out there who are, putting their trust in these millennials, but it's not without reason. I mean, a lot of these folks have been in their field for a little while, and actually millennials' decision making responsibilities increase with their age. So, you know, from age 20 to 24 year old respondents are reporting that, you know, 67% of that very young group are reporting that they're involved in overall decision making. But that number goes up to 77% for millennials who are in their early 30s. So as they gain a little bit of experience, that number seems to go up. It's not going to be going down anytime soon.
And Patrick, for those Gen Xers or baby boomers that are in these organizations that might think they might want to try to fight this influence, this is a sort of a cautionary tale, isn't it? I mean, if millennials are getting this much leeway and experience and trust from the higher ups in a company, this is something that those of us who are Gen Xers and baby boomers should really pay attention to, right?
Should definitely pay attention to it, and I don't even know if fighting it is really going to be would be really worth the time. It might just be make more sense to try to get everybody on the same page, see what's best for an organization, what kind of decisions are going to help the organization drive revenue in the end, because that's sort of the end goal for all of this. But I think that trying to find harmony and work together would probably be the best move, because, millennials aren't going away anytime soon.
And so when will we know the financial end of this? And because you just mentioned there that the end result obviously is to make money for an organization. Will there be has there been any report or research done in terms of how much money they are, in fact, making their businesses?
In terms of, driving revenue, that probably is going to vary widely from business to business and from industry to industry, the best ways to target these millennials, this is a very diverse generation of adults. So lumping them all together as just kind of as a single group is a tough thing to do. B2B marketers might want to try to focus on specific millennial buyer audiences or personas and try to target those as opposed to targeting millennials as a whole, because it's really tough to kind of lump all these folks in together, as they're such a wide and diverse group.
Patrick Gorman is the editor at Fierce CMO. You can follow on Twitter at Fierce CMO and find more, obviously, online as well. Patrick, it was good of you to get up with us and be with us on the Opening Bell this morning.
Steve, thanks so much.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:51 on the WGN Market Desk this morning. Dow futures pointing toward a lower open when the opening bell rings later this morning. Dow futures off 40. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. Oil trading lower, a little bit higher now, actually, just ticked up a bit, $48.26 a barrel. Orion Samuelson from the World of Commodities with us this morning on this Friday morning. Good morning, Orion.
Well, good morning to you. And I just checked my rain gauge here in Huntley, Illinois, and 0.6 inch of rain fell after midnight. That's really the first rain we've gotten in a week and a half or 2 weeks. It's getting very dry in the extreme counties of northern Illinois, but got a little help last night.
You were at the state fair this week. I know the state fair is wrapping up in a few days, but still plenty of time to get down there and enjoy some of what is on display. Tell us what you saw and what's the state of Illinois farmers this year?
Well, it continues to be a good livestock fair. I think the Illinois State Fair probably does as good a job of showing livestock as any fair in the Midwest. Again, we flew down at about 4,500 feet, and I didn't see a dry spot anywhere in the Illinois landscape between Chicago and Springfield. It looks green. I've never seen it look as lush and green this late in the growing season. Had the sale of Grand Champions. We had the Salute to Agriculture breakfast in the morning. Governor Rauner attending the breakfast to present awards to outstanding farm families of Illinois. And there are two categories that are interesting because they continue to grow in numbers. The centennial farms, farms that have been in the family, same ownership for 100 years, and then sesquicentennial farms, farms that have been in the same family for 150 years. And there were quite a few that were added to the list this year. As a matter of fact, to the point where they are now creating a bicentennial farm category, that would be 200 years of farm ownership by the same family. Sale on Tuesday night, pretty good sale. $250,000 really paid for the Grand Champion commodities. That's, well, there were four cheeses and there were four meat products. There was wine, there was honey, and that kicked off the auction at 4 p.m, and then it was followed by the Grand Champion live animals. Rabbits that brought $4,550, poultry that brought $4,000, and then an all-time record high for the steer of $104,000. Never paid that much before, and Lucas Wisniewski of Stark County had the opportunity to do the check. And somebody asked about, does the exhibitor get all of the money? No, the exhibitor does not. This is how they divide it up so that it is shared for 4-H and FFA. 20% of that total goes to 4-H, the foundation, and 20% goes to the FFA foundation. The exhibitor gets the rest. So that's how it works. And it was just a great night, great auction. Governor Rauner took $50,000 out of his pocket to help pay for it. Monsanto shared in buying the Grand Champion steer at the Illinois State Fair.
Now, Orion, when we talk about a family farm that's been in the family for 150 years, we on these shows, we talk a lot about business and business sense. What lessons can we all learn in business from a farm that's been in the family like that for 150 years? That, I mean, that's the basic business model, right?
Well, it is. And first of all, it takes the love of the family. I mean, you have members of that family who really take pride in the fact that they have been involved in ownership and operating the farm for 100 years or 150 years. I would say you have to have a good business mind, a good business sense, but I think beyond that, I think maybe more important to the family than that is the fact that they want to carry on the tradition. Because in all cases, you know, their grandparents, great-grandparents came from countries outside the United States, settled here in the Midwest, settled in Illinois, staked out the land, and it's been in the family ever since. But yeah, they're very proud of it.
And there's sort of this caring attitude too. It's more than just business when you're in a family business.
Definitely, because with a farm, you have children who showed up in the sale of the Grand Champions, for example. One of the things I've noted over the years, because this is the 53rd year I've gone to the Illinois State Fair, and I've noticed that exhibitors in the show getting younger. The Grand Champion Weather, that's a lamb, shown by a nine-year-old girl, nine-year-old, and it brought $11,500. And, of course, the thing is, when you say, what are you going to do with the money? College fund,
right.
And that's where it goes. So the other conversation down there was the fact that the Trump people announced the Agricultural Advisory Committee, 64 people on it. I probably know about 50 of them. But 10 of them are current or former state agriculture directors, and 10 of them are current or former governors across the country. And then they have one secretary of agriculture who came from Illinois to serve in the Reagan administration, our good friend John Block. So kind of an interesting makeup in that Trump Agricultural Committee.
All right. Maureen Samuelson, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too, my friend.
All right.